Now stay tuned for To Your Health on WPBC LP Charlottesville, the show where food is on the table and center stage. To Your Health is brought to you by Hamilton's at First and Main, celebrating 20 years of sustainable fine dining on the downtown mall. Now here are your hosts, Larry Stopper and MC Blair.
Mornings from 11 to 12 on WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. Our mission is to give listeners, that's you, the tools necessary to make healthy choices in their daily lives. And we also invite folks to call in as well at 284-9470. Larry and I are not the experts, but we'll bring in experts for your educational pleasure. Larry, what do you got?
Our aim is to spark a conversation both with us and amongst yourselves as we delve into topics ranging from what is kombucha to how global climate change will affect our food supply in the long term. Mike's more the food and drink guy, and I'm more focused on social and environmental policy and the impacts things are having on our lives. We plan to bring you voices from around our neighborhood to around the world as a vehicle to inspire these conversations. And we also hope you'll join us on this journey regularly, that you'll call in, add your voice to the conversation. We look forward to your company and your insights.
Absolutely. We're going to read some headlines from around Charlottesville, around the state of Virginia, the nation, and the world concerning food and drink and health, and discuss each headline. So I want to tell you a little bit about me and who I am right now. I came to Charlottesville in 1999 and looked up a friend who's also one of the top chefs in the area and from Norfolk restaurants, Gail Hobbs Page. What a jewel she is. She was the executive chef at Hamilton's at First and Main. Her husband's still the general manager down there. She's now a cheesemaker at her and her husband Daniel's Caremont Farm in Buckingham County. She introduced me to the sustainable way of life and the real food movement, Larry. She explained how grass-fed beef, pastured pork and poultry, and local sustainably grown and organic food was the way to go. Also the most healthy diet. Until then, I used to get the normal one or two colds or flu every year, right? But because I was basically healthy, I would only be sick a day or two. But after adopting that sustainable food diet, real food diet, I like to call it, I haven't felt sick one day. And I've only missed one day of work due to, I was a little dizzy and queasy. So I just want to shout out to Gail, a big thank you. Thank you, Gail. We're going to have her as a guest soon, folks, so you guys out there will get a real treat. We might even get her to give us a recipe that'll please your palates. And now on to the headlines, I believe.
Well, let me give you a chance to introduce myself.
Yeah, good one.
So I'm Larry Stopper, and I've spent most of my 41 years here in Virginia. I'm quite sure that everybody can recognize this isn't a Virginia accent. I was born and bred in New Jersey, but...
Jersey boy.
But 41 years now in Nelson County, giving me a serious appreciation for raising my own food as much as possible and supporting local agriculture and local food businesses. I've invested in a few, and I get to that Saturday morning market bright and early every week and have a great time there. It's a wonderful social event, but it's also really an opportunity to get the best food you can get in this area.
True.
And support your neighbors.
Keeping it
going in the neighborhood. The more money that we circulate within our metro area, do I call it, in our local area, Nelson, Charlottesville, Albemarle, Fluvanna, all that, wherever we're circulating that money locally, we are improving our economy, improving people's lives.
Well, that's true. And you've actually circulated some of your money with some local businesses.
Well, I like to do it. I put my money where my mouth is because I think that that's... along with my food, but I really believe that that's the best way to do it, is to do it yourself. You can't encourage other people to invest if you're not doing it.
That's true.
So, well, that's really where
I... So you come to the table.
Well, that's... Yeah. I try to use my belief system as a basis for how I spend my money and how, supporting local businesses.
Yeah.
Just really, it's critical. It's amazing, the food businesses. We're going to touch on it as we go through this today. We have Almost forgot for a second. We have Matt Rohde right here with us from Carpe Donut, and he'll be with us in the next segment talking about Carpe Donuts and the development of his business. And that's just one of our dozens of local food businesses that have prospered in this area. And we'll bring these guests in. Got a great friend who's making kombucha out there, friends who are making tortillas. It's just terrific.
Yeah, kombucha is really good for the digestive system.
I know. I bring up kombucha. But... I'm looking forward to bringing Ethan on the show here.
Yeah.
He's Zuckerman with
like
Barefoot
it.
Kombucha.
Yeah.
Because I don't really know what the heck that stuff is, and I want to sit across from him and just get him to break it down for all of us, because kombucha is a perfect example. We hear about it, and we hear about it, but what is it?
It has something to do with mushrooms.
I don't know. Well, we're going to explore that another time. But that's not today's subject. All right, so let's just jump right into our first subject.
Well.
All right, so that was a painfully miserable election, and we're not going to go through any details. That was as bad as it gets. But when I got up on Thursday morning and could finally turn the computer back on and face the music, I decided to cruise through the results and try to find something inspiring. Positive.
Well, a healthy way to face life, you know. Yeah.
So I started scrolling through all the various legislation that was being decided upon in the cities and states, and to my surprise, there are four more cities now that have passed soda taxes, and soda taxes are a real positive. So now we have San Francisco, Oakland, Albany, California, Boulder, Colorado, and they join Berkeley, Philadelphia, and I just read this morning that Cook County, which includes Chicago, has also now imposed a soda tax. And soda taxes are very, very effective in lowering the consumption of, I don't know, it's just bad stuff. I don't want to call it evil.
Right, well, I mean, it's one of the main causes of childhood obesity.
Yes, a big driver of childhood obesity. So in researching this, I learned, much to my surprise and delight, that soda sales have dropped by 25% from their peak in the mid-90s. And it's really helping childhood obesity levels, obesity rates, level off. School systems have started banning soda machines. Education programs are being launched. It's a very positive movement in dealing with a real scourge, which is the obesity issue. But of course, the beverage industry is fighting back pretty strongly.
Well, of course,
yeah.
But didn't you say that childhood obesity kind of leveled off as opposed to continued to grow in those states?
Yes. Oh, it's
effective.
Yeah, well, it's definitely effective. And let's see, where we got here? The big soda really has just fought this like crazy with disinformation campaigns, political contributions, and really trying to greenwash their image by making very generous contributions to organizations like the Children's Hospital in Philadelphia, which was their way of attempting to fight the soda tax in Philly. It didn't work. Didn't work in Philadelphia. They were able to pass the tax anyway. And it's really helping.
Good.
So, I don't know. What do you say, Mike? When was the last time you bought a soda?
I can't really remember. 20 years ago? Something like that.
Because I was a real Coke addict. I'm going to admit it. And that kind of Coke.
The soda.
The soda.
Yeah, we'll save that for another show, right?
Yeah, I was a heavy regular Coca-Cola drinker, and it took some real effort to put it down and walk away. I started drinking root beers for a while, but I mean, it's no better.
They would add, especially in the diet. Remember when that first came in, the diet soda craze? And everybody was drinking it, and then people were complaining of headaches and whatnot. And they found out that the sweetener in that aspartame was curative. It's cured wood alcohol, so it's like. That might get some nervous damage or nerve damage there, you know, with that stuff. I've never heard any really good stuff about it. So it's really not very good for you. You know,
well,
what can you say?
Education That's what needs people need all the time. You really have to understand what it is that you're putting in yourself. And soda is a perfect example of a very desirable drink that's
it is
essentially poison. Yeah.
We'll probably have some, we'll get a doctor or two up on here and talk about that further.
Nutritionists. We'll bring in some nutritionists to expand further on this stuff.
Absolutely.
All right. So what else?
I just wanted to say about how local food it's an old trend and started with the hippies in California back in the 60s and it did quite well. Of course, it always does well in California since it's kind of a growing season. 12 months, they always have the freshest in the nation. But it is expanded into our area and as around the world, or excuse me, around the nation. People call it farm to table, farm to fork, whatever you want to call it. But there's a growing number of people that are taking an interest of where their food comes from, and that was what Gail had pointed out to me, and for many the closer the better,
Sure.
But depending on their level of commitment, there's a number of ways that local shoppers can get Central Virginia's finest meats and produce for their tables.
Over in Europe, that's the way it's been for a long time.
You're right.
That's just the way that they've operated with all those little butcher shops and little produce stands. It's in many areas of Europe, that's just common. But in this country, the distribution has gotten so easy in many ways that it's in some ways really it's easier to eat Chilean grapes, for instance, than it is to get anything local.
Well, you've got the big distributors, and they sort of took over that, and then went into the factory farms and all that, and it was to make it cheaper and obviously more profitable for the stockholders. We were an agrarian society for many, many years, and then, of course, that changed. But the definition of local, that's, what is local? I don't know. In the region, some people say any food produced within 400 miles. But Joel Salatin from Polyface Farm defined it. I like it better than that. He says within 100 miles.
Seems a pretty reasonable definition.
It does. And people talk about how, the factory farms are the only way to feed the whole nation. Well, in fact, I guess in the past probably 10 or so years, we found out that the best model for getting local food is with local food hubs. Mm-hmm. And we have one here, and that's what it's called. But there's food hubs. There's several hundred food hubs around the nation, and what they do is they deal with the local farmers, and it's a central area that they can bring their food to, and then the local food hub distributes it through deliveries to people. Also, people that are infirmed, they have a program where they can bring it right to your door. Mm-hmm. Most of the time, they bring it to a central area where people come and pick up their boxes of food. So the nation could be fed with local farmers. Through that, which is, of course, Big Ag doesn't want you to know about that one.
I was in New Jersey and New York last weekend, and I was amazed at the farmers markets that are in very tight urban areas. I mean, right on the streets of Brooklyn was a big farmers market. Huh. And at Prospect Park in Brooklyn was still another farmers market. It was astonishing. It gave me great insight into how the local food movement has really spread right into the largest of our urban areas. These were all farmers from the Catskill Mountains and a little bit in western New Jersey that were coming in and supplying Brooklyn.
Wow.
I just thought it was fantastic. I couldn't believe the array of fresh food that was still available in mid-November, right there on the streets of Brooklyn. It was very encouraging.
That's great. There's another program called Edible Schoolyards.
Okay.
Started in Berkeley in 99. Alice Waters out at Chez Panisse started it with the help of some of the local educators. And we actually have here at the Beaufort Middle School, there's a program with Edible Schoolyards, Schoolyard Garden. We'll be getting with those folks and getting more information about that. But basically what it is, they allow the students, first off, they plow up some of that ground, you know, that, you know, you see around schools has all that grass. They plow that out and turn them into gardens. They let the students there at the school grow the food and the vegetables, and they serve it at school lunches so they can get healthy meals there at the lunches. Yeah, and they also have after school programs and summer programs for these students to come in and to do that as well. So that's one way of educating younger people so that they come up to know about how to, you know, that real food does in fact work. Keeps them healthier.
Well, that you can grow your own.
You can grow it your own.
You don't need a whole farm. In urban areas, it's quite amazing how much food can be grown. You can grow tomatoes in pots on your balcony.
Absolutely.
There's many, many ways. Urban gardens and urban farming has become a trend, especially in some of the Midwestern cities that are emptying out to some extent, the Detroits and Milwaukee's.
Yeah, yeah.
Urban farming is a real movement.
It really is.
And it's very successful. And
it is.
Helping, again, lower-income people improve their diets and gaining better access.
Yeah, I want to bring Matt in here. Matt Rohde from Carpet Donut. He's got a wealth of knowledge about this.
Thank you, Mike. Thank you, Larry. Thank you for having me here.
Our pleasure.
You bet. All right. Well, so we only got a couple minutes in this segment, and we'll bring Matt back into the second segment here. But let's just start off with Carpe Donuts. Fill us in a little bit, Matt, on your background.
Well, thank you. I don't have a background in food business or entrepreneurship. This was the first business that I'd ever started. But I did have a background in food and cooking from my college days when I helped run a restaurant and ended up being the manager after graduation. But I spent the last 15 years before starting Carpe as a social worker, working with at-risk teenagers. The last 10 of those for the city of Charlottesville for community attention. And even in that work, I was using food as a connecting tool to kind of reach people on an emotional level and a supportive level. So when the time came to start another food business, I definitely knew the emotional side was going to be as important as the financial side. And thank goodness, because it's not always been as easy as all that. But Carpe Donut was started out of an idea that we'd like to do an organic ingredient food. We had small kids. My wife and I both felt strongly we wanted to make a nice, simple food product. Something that would be kind of irresistible, made hot and fresh, but made with the kind of ingredients that we would feel really good about serving our own children. I like the idea of going to donuts because I think we need organic comfort foods. I think the success of companies like Chipotle shows that people want different food sensibilities baked into the same kind of food they've always liked to eat.
Yeah. Yes.
We have a whole cultural connection to food that transcends sometimes what it's made out of. When you can turn those expectations on their head. If I'm making the healthiest version of a donut that's still a donut, not masquerading as a granola bar or something else, I think there's room for that in the world. And starting that business in Charlottesville in 2007 and having been able to simply survive and be okay over 9 years, to me says a lot of other people felt that way as well.
Yeah.
So what differentiates a Carpe Donut from...
Yeah,
dare I say some of the other?
Well, we don't need any. I mean, there's other good donuts in the world. They just aren't necessarily putting the priorities where we are. We're looking at every ingredient. And first of all, what's different is that we're making them from scratch. The vast majority, of especially all the non-artisanal donut makers out there in the world, the Dunkin' Donuts, the Krispy Kremes, even most of the small mom and pops are buying commercial donut mix. It's full of dough stabilizers.
Oh,
it's full
man.
Of emulsifiers. It's got preservatives in it. It's got a lot of stuff that... It, from a culinary perspective, is very helpful because it is make sure that your donut comes out the same way every time.
Yeah, we're going into a break right now, and we'll have Matt and back after that.
Thanks so much for listening to WPVC and to your health. See you in a couple minutes.
We're back.
All right, so we're talking with Matt Rohde right now of Carpe Donuts. And Matt was explaining about the donuts. I wanted to ask you a little bit more about getting a business like yours going in Charlottesville. So what kind of difficulties did you encounter?
Many of the difficulties we faced were similar to anybody starting a small business. You got to figure out how you're going to get some capital together. You need to figure out how to make a, for lack of a better term, a business model that could generate a little bit of surplus, that can make some profit, that can keep you growing and developing more effective ways to do stuff all the way along. That's stuff that I've retroactively learned over 9 years. Some of the embedded advantages of setting up a business like ours in Charlottesville is in this community, we didn't have to explain what organic flour or local pastured eggs meant. We didn't have to explain the idea that we were going to build something up from scratch and that the ingredient, the donuts might look a little different every time you make them because we're not using dough stabilizers. We're not using anything with a complicated chemical name. The most complicated chemical that goes into our donut is table salt. And people kind of get that. And that story that we put together on some hand-painted signs and hung outside our little donut trailer, people got it intrinsically. And in this community, I had many, many times when I would watch a mom and a couple kids coming out of the library, and the kids are going, donuts, donuts, donuts. And mom's going, no, now we're not going to have that. And then look down and see my signs, take a long pause and go, actually, yeah, we'll get a donut. That sounds good. And that was a little embedded advantage that a business like ours had here. I don't know if we would have had that back in 2007 in some other big urban areas, in other communities that didn't have Charlottesville's amazing food sensibilities, a sense of community around trying to do food differently.
So you think the local culture, the local food culture,
absolutely. Absolutely. And you guys were talking about having Ethan in from Barefoot Boots.
Right.
Wearing one of his shirts today. I was one of his first customers. There's a network of small business people, and I've worked with Gail, and I've worked with many of the people that I'm sure you'll have on the show, just sharing information. If you guys talk with Stephanie Murray at ULA, she came to me when she was starting the business just to get the answers to some of those questions about what do I need about insurance? How do we get our price point down? What should we do if we're going to go talk to Whole Foods about carrying the product? And there's a great network and community of food producers in this within an hour of Charlottesville who are really willing to talk to each other and share those experiences.
That's great. You're also in the city markets, right? Well, the market at in Nellie's Ford and also the one here in Charlottesville.
We are. We've been at the Nelson Market for going on third year, and this was our first permanent spot in the Charlottesville City Market. These are fantastic venues for small food businesses like ours to reach people directly and close the loop. We've also been in distribution to 100 grocery stores, and that is a different set of problems. Given my choices, I'd always rather be making the food directly and putting it in somebody's hands.
Right. Right. When we talked the other day, and you were talking about sugar, sort of the history of sugar and all that. And I know that excess sugar is not good for us.
Sure.
But if you're going to eat something that has sugar in it, you want it to be real sugar, you know.
Absolutely. No, and our sugar when we started the business was just conventional, good quality, Domino or Diamond sugar, something that you would buy in the grocery store.
Right.
About 4 years in, and my wife Jen and I started the business together. She's more in the aesthetic side. I'm more in the food and the direct production side. But she was saying, when are we going to get to organic sugar? Why isn't that happening? And at the time, organic sugar was about three times as expensive as conventional. And now that's dropped down with some better supply chain opportunities to about twice as expensive as conventional. And we made, when it was still three times as expensive, we made the leap. And we went, so we're only going to buy organic sugar. Now, there's a little bit of a flavor difference. It's got a little bit more natural molasses still embedded. And that's all great. And the concept of it is good. But the impact that it has to make organic sugar on the planet, what it means for the workers in those tropical areas where sugar gets produced, that they're not spraying the fields with petrochemicals, it's not bleeding into their water supply, they're getting to work in an environment, it's still not the easiest job in the world, but at least it's not, you know, literally toxic to go to work every day. That is part of what embedding organic into the kind of business that we have means to us. And sharing that information with people and saying, hey, look, we made the jump. It's literally still twice as expensive to buy this sugar as the other sugar. Honestly, we should all be eating less sugar. Sure. As you said, it's got a pretty dark history. If you go back hundreds of years and its connection to, you know, the slave trade, et cetera, yes. Why we did what we did as a world culture was about Europe's sweet tooth in the 16 and 1700s.
Yes,
it's crazy. But we also all love sugar. And I said it right on the website when we started the company. It's like, hey, we believe in real organic cane sugar because a donut is a donut. I can't make a donut and not use real sugar.
Yeah.
Now, your agave syrup and all that's great, but I can't make a donut with that. So we'll use the best version of that we can and be mindful that we're using sugar. This should be your – maybe it's a once-a-week treat. Maybe if you're like me, it's a once-a-day treat, but you're not going to necessarily live on our food product. We know that.
Right, and then when you limit your sugar intake to something like a donut or a little sugar, you know, on some oatmeal or whatever, as opposed to it's in every single thing that we eat, you know, from bread to whatever.
To sodas,
you know,
to whatever.
To sodas, right. Exactly, right. And because we're buying packaged processed food. And that folks, is the reason why local, sustainably or organically grown food is so important. You just don't get that added. Anything you want to add to it, you add to it. You don't have to worry about, you know, somebody injecting this or using this, you
it
know,
is
for,
that
to
hidden
grow
corn
it.
Syrup.
I know.
That,
it is.
And you can search it out. If you look at the ingredients, I was in the grocery store just the other day looking at a bag of chips. And there, at the end of the list of ingredients in a bag of corn chips, was corn syrup. They're just throwing it in to just give you that touch of sweet so that you'll just keep coming back for more.
Well, sugar, fat, and salt. You know, the food scientists, right. You know, years ago, the big food business went to the scientists and said, hey, what can you do with sugar, fat, and salt? And they said, we can make anything taste like anything.
Would like, as a company, to make sure that when people are having some sugar, they're well aware that they're doing it.
Right.
And I think going back to your soda commentary earlier, Larry, I really do think that sodas being ubiquitous, there's always a soda. You go to the movies, there's a gigantic bucket of high fructose corn syrup, carbonated water with just enough flavor to keep you interested, or every Big Gulp and every 7-Eleven.
Yeah.
That is something that if you wanted to just get rid of that, if you could reduce that by 50%, you would reduce people's sugar intake by such a vast quantity. I use sugar and corn syrup interchangeably there, but as you said, the corn syrup's actually way worse for you. Goes directly into the bloodstream, etc. I do think that we did an experiment this summer at Carpe, because I hope that those soda taxes are not coming after the seltzer people, because I personally am a huge fan of carbonated water if you make it yourself and do it naturally. I think that we tried this summer to say, what if we offered carbonation without the sugar and the artificial flavors and all that, and we carried seltzer water to all the events where we would normally sell bottled water, which, by the way, I'm also not a big fan of. You know, that's a lot of resources. It's because we forget to grab a water bottle on our way out the door in the morning, and we buy bottled water left, right, and center. So it's only in venues where people are asking us to bring that as a public service or to help support that. But I said, well, let's at least carry seltzer water. We'll get cans or bottles of seltzer water. I will say that my staff drank it like crazy, which is great. But we didn't sell a whole lot of it yet. We may be just a touch ahead of our time, but if we do start taxing high fructose corn syrup and artificially sweetened sodas, maybe we could leave the seltzer out of it and promote that as a healthier alternative.
That's true. Speaking of sugar, my son really surprised me back when he was about, I guess he was 6 or 8 years old, and he was playing with some friends in the front yard, and one of them had a bag. It was right after Halloween, and one of them had a bag of candy. And as you know, we all remember from those days. And you know, we'd educated Woody as far as we limited his intake of the candy and told him why we were doing it. And so one of his friends asked him, "Hey, I got some candy. Or you want some?" And he, out of the blue, he didn't know I was listening, said, nope, I've had my sugar for the day. And it blew me away. He turned down candy because he knew that too much sugar was not good for him.
My daughter would not do that. Absolutely not.
No way, right?
Well, and limiting is really the key. You're not going to eliminate this sugar,
no,
corn syrup. You're not going to eliminate it from your diet. And it's not that, it's not somehow terrible in the sense of small, moderate amounts. I'm the first to admit that I'm hard-pressed to pass up a good brownie, and chocolate chip cookies are an addiction. But you have to be able to grasp that there's a limit to how much you're going to consume on it as a way of enabling yourself to enjoy it on a daily, weekly, however much basis you like. But if you can find that balance point, you can enjoy it forever.
It's really hard to maintain that balance point in the society that we've all participated in and inherited. Every force, it seems like, is shoving at you another bag of chips, another cookie, another, you know, a bottle of soda, and that if you walk into most of the places where you can go to buy your food, I know, you know, if you go to the farmer's market, you're getting a different experience.
Yeah.
You're getting a more balanced experience. But most grocery stores present you front and center with, you know, the worst elements of dietary indulgence. And it is kind of taking advantage. It's kind of hacking our brains a little bit in a computer sense of going to the things that our brains are telling us, oh, we need more of that.
And I'll tell you that a number of the health food stores in town and around that I have seen are now also going to that model. You go up to that checkout counter now, and lined up are the chocolate bars.
Yes, sir.
Just lined up. Oh, they're good quality chocolate. Oh, they support endangered species, and they support every good cause that appeals to your heart. But they're appealing straight to that spot in your brain that says, chocolate, sugar.
Yeah,
Yahoo!
Well, you know, sugar does stimulate the opiate receptors in your brain.
Yeah.
Just like opium, you know, the opioids.
Hits those endorphins pretty hard.
I got a fun fact here about peanut butter, speaking of something that's sweet. If you go to one of these places that you grind your own peanut butter, you're getting, obviously, a lot less sugar. But peanut butter has protein as well as potassium, which lowers the risk of high blood pressure, stroke, and heart disease. It also contains fiber for your bowel health, healthy fats, magnesium to fortify your bones and muscles, and vitamin E and antioxidants. So eat more peanut butter.
It is an interesting example because the peanut butter that I know I grew up with in the house, and I won't name any any name brands, but they rhyme with Jiffy and Skip. those peanut butters are like half corn syrup.
The other half
is hydrogenated oil. I'm not sure what is actually left to be a participant. So what you talked about grinding your own, that's getting back into connection to making and being part of the production cycle of
it really is, and Virginia is a big peanut producer.
Mm-hmm. So I want to shift back to Matt here a little bit before we lose him for our last segment here, and I want you to talk a little bit about the food truck culture, if you would.
Sure. Oh, good idea.
You're pretty mobile. That's your operation.
We actually have three mobile carts in a very small brick-and-mortar space, as well as a couple of years ago we built a pilot franchise-type Carpe Donut New York City truck. So we've got a lot of experience in helping to make these food trucks happen. I happened to hear Joel Salatin talk at a event a few weeks ago, and he was talking about food trucks being the great incubator for food entrepreneurship, for people who want to try something different, who want to bring a different ethnic food or a different food sensibility out into the marketplace. Part of why that works is because it's a relatively low-cost way to try launching a business and see how the community responds to it. So we started in food trucks. We put some self-imposed limits on ourselves by having to work within a 6x10 steel truck, a little cart, actually, a pull-behind. And that, for us, was the opportunity to try out enough elements to survive, to figure out what makes this work on an economic basis. I think that's the great advantage of food trucks, is that you're going to get a chance to see a lot of different approaches. And sometimes it'll be, from a food health perspective, terrible. Sometimes it'll be fantastic. And what we get to try out is lots of different approaches to how to bring food to people where they already are.
Well, I saw one, I guess it was up near Culpeper, that's local, that was touting on the signage on the truck that they were using, local, sustainably, organically grown food.
Absolutely.
Which is just magnificent. You know, most of the time they go to wherever, you know, whatever
and,
wholesale
and not
place
to slam Culpeper, but I don't think they'd be supporting a brick-and-mortar restaurant of that scale necessarily.
No,
but they could probably support that food truck.
Yeah.
And you can take that truck and not limit yourself to just 10 miles from where you live, but go 80 miles away. Go up to D.C. Go to Roanoke. Go wherever you think a critical mass of people who want to experience the food that you have. That's part of how we've survived. It allows us to go to three farmers markets every week. It allows us to go to 120 weddings every year to bring our version of food to different kinds of markets and different kinds of groups of people that might not otherwise get to try it.
That's a very impressive way to put your toe into the food arena without risking or having to raise dramatic amounts of capital.
Absolutely, because it's really what is it they say about the restaurant business? It's a great way to lose $1 million.
It is, you know.
Lots of people
true.
Go in there and you know don't have all. There's so many pieces to the puzzle to make a full scale restaurant work well.
Yeah.
Well, there's just as many pieces of the puzzle, but they're a little bit smaller and more manageable when you're just setting up a food truck.
I would think limiting a menu to what you can comfortably produce or.
You have to. Yeah, you'll have to limit your menu.
You'll have
to keep the scale at a small... And it means you'll need to be a little more innovative with what you're going to provide. You don't want to go toe-to-toe with Starbucks. You don't want to go toe-to-toe with Burger King. That's not necessarily a winning formula. Those guys have already kind of figured out how to offer that. So it's got to be something outside that norm, and that makes it a bit of a hotbed of experimentation and new ideas. And some of those new ideas are actually going to be really old ideas, really like legacy concepts of how food should be prepared, because that's where some of the knowledge base rests.
Sure. For our next segment, we're going to be talking about down on the farm. We've got a great interview with Michael Clark from Planet Earth Diversified, and we're going to be talking about that. So,
Mike, you got that phone number again, in case anybody wants to give us a call?
You know, I do. I think it's 284-9470.
All right. Well, we haven't got that quite memorized yet, but we'll be back in just a few moments with another segment of To Your Health. Thanks for listening in, everyone.
94.7 WPVC would like to let you know that Piedmont Virginia Community Art Gallery is committed to supporting regional artists and serving the local community with arts programs, exhibits, and events. Piedmont Virginia Community College Art Gallery presents the 10th annual Let There Be Light, a one-night outdoor exhibit featuring light-centered artworks and performances. The public of all ages is invited. It's happening December 9th from 6 p.m. till 9 at PVCC. For more information, go to lettherebelightpvcc.com. Now back to your health with MC Blair and Larry.
All right. Thanks so much for bringing us back in. We have a very interesting interview coming up right now. Mike, why don't you give us the expo?
Yeah, Michael Clark has a concern out in Standardsville called Planet Earth Diversified. He's been doing that for some time, I think since 1984 at his current location. Let him mention that. He's got the best produce and eggs you can find out there. So I'll just, without further ado, I'll go and we'll do the interview and we'll talk about it.
Okay, sounds good.
MC Blair here. I'm with Mike Clark out at Planet Earth Diversified near Standardsville. He's at the city market every week selling a variety of produce, all of it fabulous. It frosted last night, so I got a call from him earlier today and said, come on out and get some free peppers. Mike, how long have you been doing this at Planet Earth?
I started Planet Earth Diversified in 1975. In 84, we bought this place and started farming here.
So since 84 at this location?
Yeah, we got 15 acres here. We're down in the the bottom field right now picking peppers that bordered by Blue Run right near where Swift Run and Blue Run run together.
Yeah, I think I can hear it.
Yeah, you probably can. And there's probably a few deer watching us right now, too. But and once in a while, a black bear. But they're more interested in the food. We've been here since 84. I continued to work as an engineer in a couple of different places. And about 95, I quit different engineering positions, been farming full-time ever since. Last time I saw a paycheck.
So, obviously, we're rewarded well with financially. What about farming that gives you, say, that same sense of accomplishment slash satisfaction?
Being outside is very important to me. I don't do well inside fluorescent lights over a long period of time. Get depressed. But the biggest thing for me was being able to put all of my labors into something that I put my hands on, working on spacecraft or satellite electronics. I never got to use the tools that I built other than in the lab or in the test bay. So it was nice to have something where the things I built, I got to use every day, and they accomplish a task of bringing food to people. So, you know, that feels really good. I missed the big budgets and that I want. But we've got a little electronics lab here on the farm. We build some of our own electronics and controls and build our own farm machinery. We modify and make some custom things. So we're still doing a lot of those things. I think the biggest thing is just being close to nature. When you're in a large corporate environment, you really get very disconnected.
So you make your own biofuel, right?
Yeah, we make biofuel from vegetable oil. We also recycle hydraulic fluid, motor oil, and vegetable oil in that system too, for heat, which doesn't require the same processing as a biodiesel does. And we reclaim a lot of energy from waste processes like the walk-in where we were just up at the barn. The reject heat from that preheats the wash water. So when you wash your hands in the bathroom, it's warm water that's made from the reject heat out of the walk-in. So there are a lot of things like that that I still get to invent and do and build. And I do some energy consulting on the side in the spare time when my eyes are half open for other operations that they're trying to do things like that. We do some geothermal. We're trying to do some more solar down here. The tax credits have been kind of a little crazy, and some of the funding that we thought we had to do some of those things evaporated. But energy is a big thing. Monitoring that, we did in 2002, got an award for a clean water farm, because we built our own on-site water reclamation system.
Wow.
We drove by it. And so all the wastewater from the greenhouses was processed through that, and we reused it as irrigation and reclaimed all the nutrients from that and saved that water. But that way, if we do get a high water event or a lot of rain, some standing water, just standing in the rows in between.
Do you till the soil?
Yeah.
So, but it's like a minimal.
Yeah, there are a couple of implements over there. You see that V-shaped disc?
Yes.
Which is like six discs that all kind of come to a funnel.
Sure, yeah.
Point. And so they build the beds.
Oh, okay.
And then there's a tiller that will make seed bed out of that piled mm-hmm. up bed and shape it. But you know, there's not a moldboard plow. There's not a giant disc. Well,
okay.
Anytime you're doing serious tillage, you're going to set it back. And it comes back.
Right.
And I mean, these things were done in the spring, and we haven't moved them. And so everything is kind of recovered. We've gone through several cover crops
mm-hmm.
between the row, and you know, does that mean the soil's still soft?
Yeah.
And when you were pulling those plants up before, you'd see, you know, good root systems, and it's not like hard parched clay and crack.
Absolutely.
And stuff.
All right, so Mike, what'd you think of the farm when you were out there?
You know, I'll tell you, it's just so much fun going out there and seeing his operation. He's got we were, of course, in the bottom land, which is actually a floodplain, technically. But and that's why he has the raised beds, so that if he does have a high water event, his beds are safe and they don't, you know, get waterlogged.
What's he raising out there mostly?
Most, you know, all sorts of produce. He also has chickens for his personal meat and the eggs. He just, you know, you name it, he has many greenhouses as well, and a tremendous microgreen business, as well as tomatoes and others. And a matter of fact, I saw him today. He's actually growing papayas, limes, and lemons.
No way.
So
papayas?
In the greenhouse. No way. I haven't seen that operation yet, but that's a whole other interview I talked to him this morning at the city market, and he told me about that, and I just kind of looked at him, stupefied. Are you kidding me?
I spent a bunch of time in Hawaii.
Yeah.
And papayas, what an opportunity to just eat as many papayas as
I know,
could.
I know. You know, so he's got quite the operation
out
there.
Is he down at the farmer's market?
He's at the city market, every week. And of course, you can come out to the farm and all that. But also, this was so incredible. He's totally sustainable in the fact that he does, as I mentioned in the interview, make his own biofuel. The vegetable oil that he talks about is not, he doesn't go and buy vegetable oil. That's oil that he presses from his veggies. You know,
really?
It's absolutely amazing. It powers the generators that keep the greenhouses warm or temperature, temperature controlled. So he makes it. It also powers all his vehicles. He doesn't go to the gas station. You know,
that's
he
great.
Is his gas station.
That's
you know,
great.
It's just amazing what he's doing out there. I'm always impressed every time I
go
out there.
I want to go back to something that you said before because I don't really quite understand it. Tell me, what is a microgreen?
Mm. Well, you have your romaine and you have your arugula and you have your spinach and all that. Well. they're actually make them small. You know, it's micro. They're very
just
small versions,
just miniature
of all
versions.
The lettuces and all that. Exactly. And I've been in that particular greenhouse. It has little pots. And a couple of years ago, not really a farm manager, but he helped with the greenhouses and Michael had some great contracts with some restaurants, that would, all their salads were these, microgreens. And the guy went out there to harvest them with a pair of scissors.
So without meaning to be facetious, is it like a bonsai, lettuce?
Yeah, I guess if you call that, sure.
Just
little miniature versions of all the lettuces, and they're so delicious. They're just sweet. You don't need dressing, trust me, on this one.
All right, that's pretty cool.
It's really, really cool. But I wanted to move on a little bit about, you hear people talk about food as medicine. Well, in the traditional sense, because it provides so many nutrients to you. But I wanted to talk about grass-fed beef, pasture pork and poultry. And I guess the main difference, I'll say in the factory farms, they finish all these, all the beef off with corn, with grain, and to fatten them up. Of course, the problem is that it gives a ruminant, which is a cows are ruminants. They have various chambers rather than a stomach, and it gives them what they call acidosis, which is the bacteria from pH imbalanced rumens and synthetic estrogens. It's terrible for them. It makes them sick, and then you have to give them antibiotics to keep them well enough to get them to slaughter. So the grass-fed or grass-finished is the way to go. It tons of CLA, which is, long-term conjugated linoleic acid, which
ooh,
is...
I like that word.
Yeah,
I have no idea what it means.
it's an antioxidant. It's a protein... connected with lower risks of cancer.
Well, there we go.
It also, grass-fed animals have high concentrations of omega-3 and vitamin A and E. They're just so good for you. Personal note, after you're 50, you have certain tests that you take and with the doctor. And I would always have polyps, which were benign, and they would remove them.
And then after eating grass-fed beef for a few years, I went in, had the same test, and I was clean as a whistle, as the doctor said. No polyps whatsoever. Of course, I told him about that, and he said, yes, we in the medical field are starting to think that your diet has something to do with health. And I said, well, way to go, Doc. You know, keep on reading. You know, I think you're right. I think you're onto something here, you know. It's absolutely incredible, the health benefits of eating, and I'll go back to it, real food, especially if it's local. Now, you know, locally you can use Roundup and all that stuff just like they can in the big ag, and that's why you have to be careful. And you talk to the farmer, you know, go out and see his operation or her operation.
You can get grass-fed beef at the city market?
You can. You can. And there's a couple of vendors there that do that as well.
I certainly know down in Nellie's Ford, the market that I go
Absolutely.
To all the time, that there are a couple of terrific vendors down there.
Yeah, and as soon as we get them as sponsors, we can talk about them. give them their names and all that, which would be great.
Caramont Farm is down there.
Well, Caramont Farm is down there. And their cheese and Gale. Gale and
Well,
Daniel.
I love those. I love the omega-3s because it's part of Mike inviting me to do this show with him. I had to start learning about some of these details. Like, what is an omega-3?
Well, what is it?
Yeah, well, it's a polyunsaturated fat, which was really cool to learn. It was like, okay, if you're going to do a food show, you better start learning some stuff. So I'm a big newspaper guy. I've always been a newspaper reader. Got it from my father, came home every night, sat there with the newspaper, never turned television on, couldn't figure out why his kids watched television, just read the newspaper. I picked that habit up. So I'm a big New York Times reader, and in the Times they have a blog. It's called Well.
Ah.
Really informative. So you're going to hear a lot of little segments in our show over time from the Well blog. And this is one I picked up this week. It was about fish. And the question was, why is eating fish good for you? What is it? Is it just because it's replacing meat? And the article went on for quite a while, talking about dark-fleshed fish like salmon and herring being rich in polyunsaturated omega-3 fatty acids, to which I had to learn what the heck was, though. They're also high in lean protein, vitamin A and D, and a lot of other good stuff.
Good stuff.
But what I was most interested in was the sustainability, because I'm really the environmental social policy guy here in this table. So I wanted to learn more about the exploitation of our fish resource in the oceans and lakes and whether it's really sustainable. Went to a website by the Environmental Working Group. And if you're interested, again, name is the Environmental Working Group. Very good consumer guide on seafood. The guide that they use, it's right on the opening page of their website. The three questions are basically richness in omega-3 fatty acids, low in mercury contamination, and sustainably produced. And the guide really suggests salmon, sardines, mussels, rainbow trout, and Atlantic mackerel as the highest in omega-3s, low in mercury. Isn't that terrible that we have to say low in mercury?
Oh,
that
I know.
There's so
I
much
know.
Contamination out there in our oceans that it's not like they're mercury-free. They're just low in mercury.
Yeah, well, that you know, that comes from gold mining, actually. And especially in South America, in the rivers, they mine and dump the mercury and they use it in the processing. And then, of course, it goes right on out to the oceans and into the fish.
Just slowly moves up the food chain.
Yeah.
It's pretty frustrating to even read that. So also this, the website really urges us to stay away from swordfish, marlin, orange roughy, shark, king mackerel, and tilefish.
That's good to know.
I got to say, I've never had a tilefish. I don't.
I've seen it on menus before.
Okay, that's it. That was pretty interesting. So I'm also a big shrimp lover.
Ah.
You know, I really can't can't live my life without too much of that.
Matt Rohde is also a major shrimp lover.
Oh, yeah? Okay. Well, so I learned that they're okay in terms of sustainability. They are low in omega-3s. They're not really great in that respect. But something that I really learned, again, in reading further into on the subject was a lot of the farm-raised shrimp that come specifically from Thailand are pretty suspect in terms of their labor practices.
Yeah.
They are, in fact, being accused in some places of using slave labor to harvest the shrimp. And that's not an exaggeration. The Rohingya people who have been fleeing Burma have been pushed in many ways into involuntary servitude, we'll call it.
So make sure you know where your fish comes from. Right.
Right? I urge you, when you're looking at shrimp, to look at U.S. wild-caught shrimp.
Absolutely. Off the coast of Carolina is a good place.
Yeah,
also
down
the Gulf.
In the Gulf.
Yep.
This is, again, it's sustainably produced. It encourages people to take care of the fishing grounds, not exploit them necessarily with drilling for oil, at least off the Carolinas right now, and just producing jobs in the U.S.
So yeah.
Stick with the farmer.
Absolutely.
Stick with the wild caught.
Yeah, wild caught and as close to home as possible.
Yeah, yeah.
You've been listening to Your Health with your hosts, Larry Stopper and MC Blair. To Your Health is brought to you by Hamilton's at First and Main, celebrating 20 years of sustainable fine dining on the downtown mall. Be listening again next Saturday at 11 for To Your Health. The show is produced by Ben Chambers, production assistance from Mike Friend.